This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with mental health, where a proposal at the State House has put the debate over involuntary treatment back in the spotlight. In Massachusetts, a judge can order someone into involuntary hospitalization for mental health treatment under certain circumstances. We are only one of three states, however, where a judge cannot mandate that someone receive involuntary outpatient mental health treatment. That's treatment without hospitalization. There's a new piece of legislation that would change that, and it is controversial. WBUR senior correspondent Deb Becker covers mental health, criminal justice, and the intersection of the two. She has been tracking this debate, joins us now. Welcome, Deb.
Thank you.
So let's dive into the law. When we say that this new bill proposes mandatory outpatient treatment, what does that mean?
Well, State Senator Cindy Friedman filed this bill. It's called an Act to Provide Critical Community Health Services. And basically, it would allow someone to ask the court to mandate outpatient treatment for someone. The legislation contains several criteria by which a judge could make a determination about involuntary commitment. And those criteria include someone would have to have been diagnosed with a serious mental illness. They would have to be considered, quote, gravely disabled and not able to care for themselves. They would have to have a history of not complying with treatment and a recent history of incarceration or psychiatric hospitalization or incidents of violence. And then once a petition for involuntary treatment is filed, the court would have to hold a hearing within 4 days and determine whether it would order treatment. And then the court would determine who would be the provider.
So let's say it does order treatment. What if somebody doesn't comply, Deb?
Well, then there would be a hearing to review whether the treatment plan needs to be amended. A provider could also say this person is not complying, so they need to go to an inpatient psychiatric facility instead. So there are many steps that would be that are outlined in this legislation that would have to be followed if someone was in noncompliance. And Senator Friedman said that noncompliance would not result in punitive measures such as incarceration.
Okay, so we noted at the top what is in place in Massachusetts right now is a judge can commit somebody to hospitalization involuntarily. So let's compare. How does that work right now?
Well, that's a state law known as Section 12, where a judge can order someone to an involuntary commitment to a psychiatric hospital for an evaluation. Under the law, a person can be held for up to 3 days, and then there would have to be another hearing to determine if the person would be held for longer-term treatment in a residential facility or hospital. This bill is different because it would allow the court to order treatment in the community. Those who support the bill say there needs to be more done for those who are not in obvious immediate crisis, because the legal standard to commit someone under Section 12 is that there must be proof that the person is a harm to themselves or others. And they say that's a high bar. And so there should be a way to get treatment in the community for those folks who may not be in a dangerous situation.
So, Deb, it seems a little confusing about whether or not somebody who is mandated into hospitalization has to actually submit to treatment, do they?
Yes. A person would be required to comply with treatment. Providers would have to testify about compliance. If they weren't in compliance, a judge could order a longer commitment. And, you know, the opponents say this is dehumanizing. It allows the government to interfere with healthcare decisions. And they're really concerned about a focus on ensuring that someone is taking psychiatric medications. They say that there have been many instances where people experience difficult side effects from medications, and the courts or orders don't take that into account, and someone may be forced to take something that's harmful.
So, Deb, let's talk about the opponents and proponents here. We've started to get into that. As I understand it, most of the mental health advocacy groups in the state are opposed to this legislation. So tell us about that.
Yeah, almost all of them really are opposed. And they mentioned several reasons why. I talked with the Disability Law Center's Rick Glassman. He points to various studies that he says show that court mandates do not improve a patient's compliance with treatment. And he said there are other studies showing that involuntary outpatient commitments are disproportionately used for people of color. But mostly, I think Glassman's you know, biggest concern is that he says when a court orders treatment, it's not effective. This is what he said.
It's coercive. It interferes with personal dignity and human rights. And it forces providers to become probation officers, and it disrupts therapeutic relationships. And it diverts resources from people who really want assistance, and it prioritizes instead people who don't want assistance.
And Tiziana, I also spoke with Sarah Davidow. She's with the group The Wildflower Alliance, and it's an organization that advocates for more supports for people with mental illness and a more holistic approach to treatment overall. And Davidow says research suggests that taking away someone's agency in their mental health care treatment causes more harm than good. And she admits that the issue is very complicated. It all depends on the patient, the family involved, the circumstances. But basically, she looks at this as if there are two ways the state can go, either forcing treatment or considering other individualized methods to help people with mental illness. Here she is.
There's two pathways. There's a pathway down which we can form a treatment system such as the one we have that focuses on trying to control people. And how many people do we lose down that path versus the path where we have space for many more interpretations of what's at the root of someone's distress? We lose people down both paths. But my experience tells me, my community's experience tells me, and research is telling me, we lose more people down the path where the focus is on taking control and power.
And Davidow is planning an advocacy day at the State House this spring to tell lawmakers about what she sees as problems with this bill and with court-ordered treatment. And she thinks state resources should be used for other things, bolstering the current mental health system and peer respite centers instead of forcing people into a standard form of treatment that might not be effective for them.
So then you also came across stories where people do support this idea of court-ordered treatment. Mm-hmm. And you talk some in some of your reporting about the Cappucci family. Tell us about them.
Yeah, I spoke with Rachel Cappucci at her home in Shrewsbury, and she spent years trying to get mental health help for her older brother, Brad. He developed schizophrenia in his late 20s. He had done well all through high school, college. He was living on his own. And then he lost his job. He moved back in with his mom in his 20s, and he just was deteriorating mentally until he reached the point where Rachel said he was in a psychotic state permanently. So they did utilize Section 12 and involuntarily commit Brad to psychiatric facilities, but he did not meet the legal definition of being an imminent harm to himself or others. And then in 2019, when they tried to commit him again, the judge did not commit him, and he said he was going west for a job. At this point, they did have a formal diagnosis that Brad had schizophrenia. They didn't hear from him for several months, and in 2021, police called them to say that Brad's remains were found outside Yellowstone National Park, where he apparently had been living under a tarp. And Rachel said her brother died of hypothermia. This is what she told me.
He didn't want to die, I know that, but there was no place for him. He was homeless, you know, and that's the harsh truth. He was loved and he needed help. Nobody wanted to help.
And so Rachel believes there should be more options for those who are trying to get mental health treatment for a loved one, especially a loved one who may not be aware of the extent of their illness. And she wonders if involuntary outpatient commitment might have helped. And lawmakers will likely hear stories like hers as they debate this bill.
So you referenced the lawmakers there. Let's move to that spot now, Deb. What are lawmakers who are sponsoring this legislation saying about their desire to see it enacted?
Well, Senator Friedman says, you know, right now, many jails and prisons are full of people who are incarcerated because of serious mental illness that she thinks perhaps that incarceration could have been avoided if it was treated sooner and loved ones were allowed to intervene. Here's what she says.
I have a number of people who have come to me to talk about their children or loved ones who are in jail because of serious crimes that were committed because of their very serious mental illness. And the families and loved ones' complete lack of ability to get them help.
So Friedman believes that this legislation would help reduce the incarceration of folks with serious mental illness, could also help reduce homelessness and risks if someone with a serious mental illness is not in treatment and is not taking their psychiatric medications.
So, Deb, you also follow addiction treatment requirements. How is this proposed law the same or different than the way the state handles that?
Well, this is different. Addiction treatment is under the law known as Section 35, not to boggle you down with all the sections here, but that law allows a court to involuntarily commit someone to addiction treatment for up to 90 days. For someone to be committed, the court would also have to determine that the person was a harm to themselves or others and that their addiction was dangerous. The largest locked involuntary addiction treatment facilities are for men, and they're located in state jails and prisons, which has been very controversial and is subject to a lawsuit at the moment.
And Deb, is there any kind of pilot or other sample program that gives us a sense of how this might work in practice here in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, there is, and supporters point to it. This is a relatively new program. It's called the Boston Outpatient Assisted Treatment, or BOAT, program. It started in 2020 for those facing criminal charges in Boston Municipal Court. This program is voluntary, though, and as I said, for those facing criminal charges, if the participant complies with treatment, their criminal charges might be dismissed. Since it began, 163 people have participated, but only 31 have graduated. So that's less than 20%. Supporters acknowledge also that this program offers an array of services with Boston Medical Center. So there are coaches, therapists, psychiatrists, peer support, housing specialists, all of these wraparound services that are not typically offered in community treatment settings.
We're talking to WBUR's Deborah Becker about a new proposal to allow courts to require involuntary outpatient mental health therapy. Deb, okay, so one of the questions that comes up, I mean, you, Martha Biebinger, have both done a great deal of reporting about our lack of mental health capacity here in the state in terms of beds, providers, et cetera. The court, you know, in this bill, does that take this into account if a judge orders? Does capacity have anything to do with it, or are those things at loggerheads? Do you understand my question?
I do, and they are at loggerheads. I mean, Senator Friedman says this would put the state on the hook, and the state would be forced to provide these services. I spoke with the judge, Kathleen Coffey, who's in charge of the BOAT program, and she says it would be unethical for the court to mandate treatment if it doesn't exist or there aren't the resources or the capacity for it. And we know that there are capacity issues. We're well aware of mental health boarding and hospital emergency departments, for example. And some of this is capacity. And of course, there's also a staffing crisis in behavioral health care right now. But one thing that folks mention frequently when I was talking with them for this story is that the system has gotten a big infusion of services at the start of this year with the implementation of the Baker administration's so-called behavioral health roadmap. And so we have new community mental health centers that have opened, urgent mental health healthcare facilities that are open 24/7, mobile crisis teams, a new behavioral health helpline. A lot of state resources were put into this to make sure that mental health care is more accessible to folks round the clock and it's more convenient. So opponents point to this new influx of services and they say the state should wait to see how this works out before there's a move toward court-ordered treatment.
Do you have a sense from the legislature about how much of a chance this bill has, Deb?
It's unclear, really. I think there's a lot more awareness about mental health, and I think folks would like to see some type of action by the legislature. But, you know, this proposal's come up before. It never made it out of committee, largely because of some strong opposition. So, you know, we'll have to see where it goes. There's also more organized support now, though. There's a new group called AOT Now. This is primarily Massachusetts families who've had a hard time getting help for their loved ones. There have been some high-profile police shootings of people in mental health crisis, most recently in Cambridge in January. So there's increased awareness that we need ways to deal with mental health and we need to do better.
Deb, what are you watching for next now?
I think we'll see what happens in the hearings on this. Some of the folks I spoke with, even folks who opposed this in the past, didn't want to talk about it this time. So it'll be interesting how this debate plays out. But certainly what we do know is that every city in the country is seeing this sort of intersection of mental illness, addiction, homelessness. We have the most visible here in Massachusetts being Mass and Cass, but it's everywhere. And, you know, something needs to be done to address, you know, what we're supposed to do to help people who are in crisis. And whether that needs to be a lot more services and a real financial commitment, that's a tough sell. So it remains to be seen, but it'll be an interesting debate.
Deborah Becker is senior correspondent with WBUR covering mental health and criminal justice. Thanks for breaking that down for us, Deb. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Dozens of diplomats from five continents will arrive in Boston at the beginning of next week to get to know the city. It's part of the Experience America Tour, which shows foreign diplomats a different U.S. city every year. Experience America is hosted by the United States Ambassador Rufus Gifford. And beyond his role as the U.S.'s chief of protocol, Ambassador Gifford calls Massachusetts home. He grew up in Manchester by the Sea and lives in Concord. Ambassador Gifford sat down with us to talk about this trip, and I started by asking him what exactly does the chief of protocol and his office do?
Well, honestly, my responsibilities are fairly wide ranging. Honestly, the way I like to boil it down is we're in essence the primary liaison between foreign governments and the Biden administration. So in essence, anytime a foreign leader is interacting with the president, the vice president, the first lady, or the secretary of state, protocol is always there putting the trips together. And in addition to that, we are essentially the chief of the diplomatic corps right here in Washington, D.C. So any foreign ambassadors that are living and working in Washington, we are essentially responsible for all of them. It's a much more in-depth job than everything I just said, but in the 30-second version, that's in essence what the job's
about. And to be really clear, when you say protocol, you mean everything from do we shake hands to do we exchange gifts to what are people supposed to be called to who it gets introduced first, who goes through the door first or sits, all those kinds of things, right?
That's absolutely true. But that being said, I think that's the sense you get when you hear the term protocol. But our office also we put together, whether it's major events and summits, anything that the president is engaged in as it relates to foreign leaders, protocol has a lead role in that. So it's everything from gift exchange to the way you address someone, but also putting together these major events and summits. So anytime the president travels overseas, we go along for the ride. I was the first to shake President Vladimir Zelensky's hand when he landed in Washington in December of this year. So it's very, very wide ranging. It never is boring. I can tell you that it's always, always, always an adventure and truly the honor of a life.
So you mentioned both events and the fact that you're, you know, sort of de facto, or for lack of a better term, responsible for the foreign diplomatic corps that is in Washington, D.C. And we're talking because those two things are meeting, right? You're bringing a group of diplomats from other countries who are normally based in D.C. to Boston for the 26th through the 28th, essentially on what I'm assuming in you know, sort of layperson's terms is a trade mission. Is that fair? Is that what we're doing?
It's a little bit more than a trade mission. I think that is in part a trade mission. But ultimately, this is part of what we call the Experience America program. People talk about being inside the Beltway and having kind of a Beltway mentality, Americans. But I actually think that's true in some ways with the diplomatic corps as well. So often, foreign ambassadors get so sucked into the Washington world, and we have an enormous country to explore. When we think about Experience America and we think about our responsibility in the protocol office, it's actually about introducing these remarkable women and men, and they truly are. If you're a foreign ambassador to the United States, you are, if not the, one of the most prominent foreign policy experts in whatever country you are from. So to bring these women and men around and introduce them to cities. And of course, Boston is very much on the internet, everyone's international radar. But some of these ambassadors may never have gone there before and never really taken a deep dive into not just the private sector piece of what we are going to be doing on Monday and Tuesday of next week, but also cultural, also the education pieces, trying to really get a sense of what these cities and towns all over the United States, what makes them special. And of course, I am biased as a Massachusetts native. It made very much sense to me that for the first major experience America trip that we go back to my hometown. So thrilled about that.
Okay. And, you know, all for the home team. I also find myself wondering if you're trying to give people from another country who are inside the D.C. bubble a really good look at what is America. I'm thinking Grand Rapids, Michigan, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Kansas City, Kansas, Boston, again, all for the home team. But Boston is a very metropolitan city that they might have gotten to. So how do you make those picks? And is there anybody who's mad at you when you pick one place and not another? I mean, these are real visits.
Well, without a doubt, and I'll take the anger. Look, if someone wants to help us put together a trip to Grand Rapids or Kansas City, sign me up for that. And I hope we have the opportunity to go there. But when I think about Boston, when I think about my hometown, and it's some of the things that Boston is known for, and I actually think not enough people know this. They do regionally, but they may not do internationally. What a leader Massachusetts is in life sciences, biotech, climate. We really want to do a bit of a deep dive, as much as you can do a deep dive in 36 hours, and really introduce them to not only the major businesses, the major economies that have really grown up in and around the city, but also some of the newer ones, some of the research facilities and some of the entrepreneurs that are really driving the economy in and around Boston. So I always think there's more to do. Not that we're not going to go to second or third tier cities that maybe never attract ambassadors, but I really think, and again, I'm biased. I will be the first to tell you that I'm biased, but I am really, really excited to do a deep dive into my hometown. And we'll be taking these ambassadors to from everything to Harvard and MIT to the Kennedy Library and Fenway Park, as well as introduce them to some of the most prominent business leaders in and around the city. So I think we're going to do a pretty exciting introduction into Boston, and hopefully there'll be some real legitimate partnerships built from it.
So what does a legitimate partnership look like?
So I think historically, any one of a number of different things have happened. It could be as simple as an airline, a foreign airline, or a domestic airline may be wanting to start a new route from Boston to their country. Perhaps it's an education exchange. We will, as I said, be going to Harvard and MIT. And you think about the international student population, which Boston has fostered over the course of our history. And we could certainly see more of that. And again, if you think about the atmosphere that exists with life sciences or climate, maybe there are, when we think about foreign direct investment, maybe there are foreign businesses that want to look at Boston or the larger New England region as an opportunity to start up some sort of U.S. subsidiary. And this has happened before. And we're going to be introducing them to business political leaders that could actually help build those relationships. And I will say I did this. I did serve as U.S. ambassador to Denmark in the second term of the Obama administration. And we brought a trade delegation to Washington, D.C., and then at my urging to Boston. And if you look at, not only are there now nonstop flights between Boston Logan Airport and Copenhagen, which there are, if you look at one half of Vineyard Wind, that is something called Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, which is a Danish business. So things like that can absolutely and directly come from initiatives like this. And we much hope more can be built.
To be clear, you're drawing a direct line to Copenhagen. I'm sorry, I missed the full name of the company, and Vineyard Wind from that visit, from that time.
I will never take full credit for anything that has happened. But the point is there was obviously the environment that existed in Boston. Former Governor Deval Patrick was very committed to investing in wind. We know about that. And we feel like we created an environment where we brought foreign investment to help learn more about the climate in Massachusetts. And that led to some of this investment that we're seeing. And I think that coming out of trips like this, we can see more of those. That's what a successful trip looks like to me.
We're talking with Ambassador Rufus Gifford, raised in Manchester by the Sea, yes?
Raised in Manchester by the Sea. Now I consider myself a proud resident of Concord, Massachusetts.
And chief of protocol for the United States of America. About this upcoming trip, you're bringing a number of diplomats from Washington, D.C., who are from other countries, here to Greater Boston. So a few other questions for you, sort of on the logistics of this trip. Who's coming? What countries are represented? How many are coming? And what are some of the key countries represented?
It's five continents, I can tell you that. So you're going to see countries big and small from Europe, from Central and South America, from Australia and Oceania and Asia. So it's across the board. We invite everybody. Not everybody can come, but it will be a broad swath. So I think you'll see every region of the globe represented over this 36-hour trip that we have to Boston next week.
And in addition to places like you mentioned, Harvard and MIT, and I know you're looking at some, you're emphasizing life sciences and biotech, a Pfizer, for example, Mass Bio, Kennedy Library, any like little local restaurants or local shops? Is there a chance for them to meet, sort of the everyday people in Greater Boston?
Well, this is actually one of the fun things. So on Monday night, our second night there, one of the kind of key sort of fun things about this these trips is that we actually split all the ambassadors up and we find hosts, local hosts who are either willing to open up their homes or host us at local restaurants. So the idea behind it isn't always just being spoken to by these organizations or business leaders or political leaders. This is actually and allows them to have a conversation with local members of the community, whether they are business or cultural or political leaders. And so I think we have five or six of those dinners planned in and around the city, both at people's private homes and also at restaurants. So,
and yes. Can you tell us who any of the hosts are?
Oh, I don't want to. I don't think I can do that right now, sadly. But I will say it this way. There's a number of folks who have been ambassadors before, who are engaged in diplomatic work, et cetera, and are very, very eager to welcome some of these ambassadors into their city.
So, you did mention earlier Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, Vineyard Wind, the possibility of business investment, et cetera. And I am mindful, and I want to ask you how you think about that, especially with somebody who's really got sort of local residency skin in the game on this, right? Proud resident of Concord now, grew up in Manchester by the Sea. When one does something like this, regardless, one is picking winners and losers. You picked life sciences and biotech, right? Local farming is huge in our area. We have a brewing industry that is up and coming. There are lots of other industries, lots of restaurants that nobody will go to. Cities and towns like a Hartford, Connecticut, or a Providence, Rhode Island, who are going to say, hey, right? You're always picking winners and losers. How do you think about that, about the power of the choices that you're making here? And equity and fairness, what are the things you put in place?
Yeah, all terms that are near and dear to my heart in every way. So I think about it in two ways. One, I think about it as it relates to the place where we're visiting. Does it have the right climate, in essence, to host, to understand what it means to actually have between 30 and 40 of these most influential folks from around the globe coming to Boston and to be able to have to be able to host them and understand the value of this. So that really does matter. Secondarily, I actually think about my, you don't want to say clients, but in essence, in this sense, my clients are the foreign ambassadors. And what do we want to show them? And taking it back to my experience as ambassador before, one of the things that I always loved about serving in Denmark is that they actually had technology that did not exist in the United States, right? So they were very invested in offshore wind. And up until a couple of years ago, there was no offshore wind in the United States of America. And that, of course, is changing quickly. And why is one of the reasons why it's changing is because some of these foreign companies who do know how to do it and do it cost effectively in a way that's saving the planet came and looked at regions of the country like New England. So one of the reasons why we focus on things like life sciences, biotech, climate is because some of these countries that will be visiting us in Boston next week may have technology that can allow us to continue to grow. when I think about putting this together, when I think about the local community, what they have to offer, and of course I'm biased, not as I've said multiple times now, but also about the people who are visiting and what they can get from it. And I think Boston is a real good place to start. Remember, we're just coming out of COVID. We haven't done this in quite some time. And if we could, we'd do this in every city across the globe and invite these ambassadors to see the best and the brightest of every community, big and small. But in Boston, I think we got a nice little recipe for success here.
Place you're most excited to visit?
Yeah, well, so me, it's Fenway.
All right.
So I've been to Fenway over and over and over again over the course of my life. And now we get a backstage tour, which I have never done. So I am thrilled. I am thrilled about that. Separate and apart from that, I know we have a few hours at some labs at Harvard and MIT. I'm a nerd deep down, and I'm incredibly, incredibly excited to see what's being developed.
Yeah, but you picked Fenway.
Well, but I picked Fenway.
And I get it. No. Will traffic be terrible and security be high with all these diplomats coming through the city?
It shouldn't be too bad. No, it's we will, of course, check all the security boxes that we need to check, but it should be a fairly mellow footprint for all involved. And we will, in essence, be providing one nice bit of transportation for folks and a little bit of bonding on a bus over the course of 36 hours for all these ambassadors, which is nice for them as well, too. Because, again, coming out of COVID, to build these diplomatic communities in cities and towns around the United States hasn't happened for a few years. And it's nice to be able to bring this back again.
All right. Rufus Gifford is United States Ambassador and Chief of Protocol, and he's leading the 28th Experience America Tour, which will come to Boston March 26th through 28th. Thank you so much, Ambassador.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's an honor to be with you.
In 2001, Jane Swift became acting governor of Massachusetts. She was the first woman to hold the position and the first person to give birth while in the state's top job. Before all that, she was also the youngest woman ever elected to the Massachusetts State Senate. And those firsts were not without a cost. In this commentary, Jane Swift reflects on how the media focused on her physical appearance and family life 20 years ago. And she notes that even today, those topics can still drown out all others when it comes to women in power.
About a month ago, I fled from a Massachusetts Women in Politics event. For reasons unknown to me at the time, I felt angry, sad, and confused. I just had to get out of there. At first, I thought it might be grief. My husband, Chuck, died just over a year ago, and February is full of personal landmines. It took me a while to get to the heart of my frustration, and surprise, it wasn't grief. In Massachusetts, women in politics are achieving extraordinary things. There are lots of women in positions of power and influence. It's a reality that seemed awfully far from reach while I was on Beacon Hill. But here I am, the proverbial skunk at the garden party. As governor, the majority of press coverage I received was about my body, my hair and wardrobe, and the audacity of my decision to start a family. But in recent months, I've reemerged in a more sympathetic light. For example, a Boston magazine writer came out to Williamstown to make amends, of sorts, for showing up on my doorstep, uninvited, 2 decades ago. Back then, I'd chewed her out for violating my privacy while standing in my bathrobe very pregnant with twins. Until now, I haven't ever discussed what actually made me so upset that evening. At the time, our house was home to older people struggling with health issues and their many cats. We could barely afford to convert it to a two-family dwelling. I wasn't exactly inviting the media in, because I felt embarrassed. We weren't poor, but we were only steps from it. I didn't fit the profile of what a governor should look like, and I paid for it dearly. I've never forgotten that feeling. The muscle memory of that discomfort and shame is what came flooding back at that Massachusetts Women in Politics soiree. At the event, nearly everyone commented on my hair and appearance. "You look great. I love your hair. Love that outfit." But few asked me about my work. I guess by traditional beauty standards, I do look better. I've got a more expensive haircut. My wardrobe has definitely improved. Grief has gotten me on a consistent workout schedule and an inconsistent eating schedule. Though trust me, I'd go back to having bad hair and extra pounds in a heartbeat if it meant having Chuck by my side. In all those interactions, I was being lauded for attaining some superficial status of woman to be admired. I couldn't bear it. The focus on my looks, even as a positive, felt just as diminishing as the negative. It frustrated me just as much as the press coverage did 2 decades ago, perhaps even more so coming from a room full of empowered women who should know better. The world remains entirely too focused on hair, hemlines, and husbands. And the implicit bias against women continues to be fueled not just by gender, but also race and class. Even those of us who fight it, practice it. So the next time you're at a work event, no matter how pink or festive, condition yourself to make your first comment about work. Here's a good icebreaker. What have you been working on?
Jane Swift is the former acting governor of Massachusetts. She recently found an animal rescue and education center on her farm in Williamstown. To read her essay and many others, visit WBUR.org. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and you are listening to Radio Boston.
Into the woods, it's time to go. It may be all in vain, I know. Into the woods, but even so, I have to take the journey. Into the woods, the path is...
Maybe you know it, but if you don't, that is the Broadway cast of Into the Woods performing the musical's title number on The View. A few months back, Into the Woods is now on the road, and it is opening a 2-week run in Boston tonight at the Emerson Colonial Theater. Katie Garrity will be on stage playing Little Red, as in Little Red Riding Hood. Garrity is originally from Gloucester. She's been playing the part of Little Red since she first joined the show on Broadway back in September. And Katie's on the line, not here in Studio 2, because the show must go on. So, Katie, welcome on the line to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
All right, so it is a storied tale. You know, you dream of the theater, star goes to Broadway and comes home. How does it feel, Katie?
It's honestly so wild, and you don't really even think about what coming home might feel like after the big dreams and the shiny lights kind of exist elsewhere. But the entire time during the plane ride and the bus here and the whole travel, my cast was laughing at me because I was literally bouncing in my seat. I'm so excited to be here.
Will your family be there tonight?
Oh, yeah. There's going to be so many people at every show. I'm actually just trying to like keep it all straight, who's coming to what one, so that I don't miss anybody. But yes, it will be very well attended.
So let's talk about the show. Some may not have seen it. There was also a movie version in 2014 starring people like Meryl Streep, Emily Blunt, James Corden. So this is a story where fairy tales meet in the woods. Tell us about it.
Yes, it's kind of based around a baker and his wife, and they are trying to break a spell that will allow them to finally conceive a child. And in that, they run into a witch and Jack and the Beanstalk and Little Red Riding Hood and Cinderella and Rapunzel and so many other people that we know. And they kind of all get caught up with each other until the end of Act One, which is kind of everybody's happily ever after. And then we start Act Two and we kind of see what life looks like beyond that.
Which is not necessarily smooth sailing happily ever after.
No, it is not.
So then we've got the character you're playing, Little Red, you know, clearly based on Little Red Riding Hood, although with a kind of sassy feminism and worldliness combined with the innocence of a child who meets a predator, basically. Mm-hmm. Really interesting character. How do you feel about, tell me what it means to play Little Red.
She's such a delicious little kid as a character. Our director, Lear, talked to me at one point and she said, I believe that she might be the smartest person on stage and she also happens to be the youngest. And I fully agree with that. I think that the show starts and everybody is kind of afraid of the woods. And Little Red is very unafraid and kind of learns that maybe fear is something that keeps you safe and grounded and that pain must be felt and life does go on. But all of the sassiness is a lot of me just bringing myself to it. I actually been playing Little Red my entire life. My first time was in 2003 at North Shore Music Theater in Beverly, Massachusetts. So that 20-year anniversary is coming up really quick, which feels bizarre to be back here as all of that's happening. But it's kind of been a lifelong career.
So I'd like to point out, as you mentioned, a 20-year anniversary, you're in your 20s.
I am. I'm 29. Yes.
Yeah. So when we say 20-year anniversary, we really are talking all the way back to childhood. And I want to talk about that a little bit. So I'm going to play some sound for you here. And again, we're speaking with Katie Garrity from Gloucester, stars as Little Red in Into the Woods, coming off of Broadway and here in Boston for the next couple of weeks. So this is a video. It's from Instagram. You're singing Little Red's big solo, I Know Things By Now, when you were a little peanut. Here we go. Okay, so not the greatest son, but you get that sense of the littleness of you. And now some sound from you performing the same song on this tour.
And I know things now, many valuable things that I hadn't known before.
And to put that in perspective, that's at the Kennedy Center. So that sets up a couple of questions that I want to ask you. The first being Little Red Riding Hood, Little Red, in this story, and the wolf, is a simple, fun fairy tale story, and as is many things in Into the Woods, double and triple entendres that really bring in some very serious sexual themes, predatory themes, themes about gender roles, etc. What is it like to play it at 9, right, when there's only so much you can conceive of? And then play it at 29 when there's a whole world you can conceive of that you probably didn't the first time.
Sure. I think at 9 or any of the younger iterations of me playing it, it's kind of, I Know Things Now felt like the song where we taught the audience a lesson and we were very proud of ourselves. And that is how we kind of ended our story. And now playing it at 29 and knowing everything that I know now in my still very young life, but much older than I was at the time, I think it's almost comical that she thinks that she knows so many things. And she does think that it is the end of her show right there. And then life kind of rudely smacks her down to size right afterwards. But this storytelling it now, I'm much more aware of all of the pain that she goes through, especially in Act Two, not to spoil a lot, but it gets pretty dark and pretty emotional. And there is a big scene near the end where I am in tears, where in the whole rest of the show, she's pretty snarky. So it's a little bit of a shock to the audience. And I can see it on some faces if they're close enough for me to see that they're really gobsmacked that she's just a kid. And I think that I've never understood more that she's just a kid now that I'm no longer a kid at all.
And does that track any part of life for you?
100%. I think this show is so beautiful, and it happens even just on Broadway. The first time it happens, it was in the middle of the AIDS crisis, and right after it, the first revival was right after 9/11. And now we're doing it on the heels of COVID. And this show demands to be seen, especially when the public needs it the most. And there are so many lessons in all of these fairy tales and the way that these unbelievable actors are playing them, that you will hear something different every time you meet it. And that's so intentional.
So there are any number of young listeners who hear that you were born in Gloucester and you made it big. So let's talk about that a little bit. How does a girl from Gloucester make it so big?
North Shore Music Theater, I really have to credit with getting me going on theater. I did A Christmas Carol in 2001 when I was 7, which was a bit of an accident. I kind of went to practice auditioning because I wanted to prepare for a Nutcracker season in Boston because I was dancing at the time. And I just accidentally got cast. So I was in that show and I continued to train there. And I had some really unbelievable local dance and voice teachers that totally led me through this journey and worked a lot in this area. And then I ended up going to college at UMass Amherst, which was also a wonderful theater education, as well as studying other things. And Broadway happened almost immediately with Groundhog Day in 2017 through actually a connection I had made at North Shore Music Theater doing Shrek in 2015. So all of this area has led me directly there, actually.
So Katie Garrity, UMass Amherst is not the one that people think of when they think I want to train for the theater and for musical theater. It tends to be more Emerson or Harvard. What was it about UMass Amherst that drew you there? What did it offer you that was special or important to you?
it didn't start out offering me anything in my own brain. I auditioned for many musical theater schools. I think the list was like 12 in total, and I actually didn't get in anywhere, which was tragic at the time, but it's just a funny story now, I guess. But when I went to UMass, I kind of intended to transfer out. I wanted to go to college and get some gen eds out of the way, but I was feeling a little lost. And what it did offer me, they do have an unbelievable theater program. It is a Bachelor of Arts, so it's a little bit more umbrella than, say, a fine arts education. But I learned a lot about the theater as an industry and technical theater and playwriting and all of that stuff that kind of reminded me that this industry is so much larger than just me on stage every night. And then on top of that, I also studied psychology and education. And a lot of who I am is based on the fact that theater is not my entire life. So UMass gave all of that to me, and when I didn't even know I was looking for it.
Katie, one of the things that strikes me, you talk about at the time you were dancing when you were younger and you auditioned for A Christmas Carol. You were interested in the ballet. You have gone forward in your life and become an outspoken advocate for body positivity, which is an interesting juxtaposition to the culture of ballet. And how did you get to that place, to becoming a spokesperson and to wanting to advocate with your platform there?
I've been really wildly fortunate because I know that the first time that a student usually gets a painful piece of information, it usually comes from a teacher, which is terrible to think about because they are who should be safeguarding us, in my opinion. But I was really fortunate to have teachers that were honest and kind, but never cruel with their opinions on how I may look or what that may do in the theater industry. And I didn't even realize it until much older, but they were building an armor around me that I wasn't even aware I was wearing. So by the time I got to the first really ugly comment thrown my way, it bounced right off and I didn't pay any mind to it. And I just kept barreling through. But I think the first time I really noticed that maybe this is something that I need to talk about to help other people, I did a hairspray for a year out at Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And there were so many student groups that would come there. And no matter what, there would be one or two, usually female, usually plus size people coming out, and I would be open up the door for the stage door and they would already be in tears. And I just was so overwhelmed by that, where I said, wow, maybe this is something that I really should be sharing my voice. And I am not ever quiet. And I've learned that that's maybe my superpower here.
So in 10 seconds, Katie, what are you going to use your superpower for next?
To make sure that every student believes that their own opinion of themselves is the most important one.
All right. Katie Garrity plays Little Red in Into the Woods, which is playing in Boston today through April 2nd at the Emerson Colonial Theater. Born and raised in Gloucester, congratulations on your success. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening. Hey, join us tomorrow when Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey is on the air for her monthly appearance on Radio Boston. We'll see you there.